When anyone goes to a Christian church, church dedicated to Jesus, you have no expectation that Jesus himself will be there, at least not coming out in the minister's robe and delivering the sermon. You may have the idea that his spirit is there, but the thought of him as a physical person walking around is very remote from the average person's mind, no matter how deeply devoted. Only a few Christians actually think of him like that. St. Francis, you know, St. Teresa, the ones who are saints through that tradition are the ones who really saw and walked with him. And yet there is this expectation built up over many centuries, a sort of fixed belief that everyone shares and really doesn't, for the most part, stop to question, that nonetheless the church is dedicated to Jesus and that Jesus is there in somehow helping us and blessing us. Many people who purport to be Christians don't really examine that very carefully. But many people who are doctors and lawyers don't examine what they're doing very carefully either. That's just the way we live. We sort of live with a certain understanding of this is what happens, and only a few people in life really examine things deeply. All of you are among them. I know a friend of mine once was remarking, she was a very dedicated disciple of this path, and she remarked that she was not a very creative person. But the fact is, as I said to her, you must be a very creative person because you were able to see in this wide world a completely alternative path, which is instead of just accepting the material world as the true world, you're willing to come into this non-physical reality. My voice sounds real funny to me. Does it sound funny to you? What's our problem? I doubt if that's it, but is that enough? Does that change it enough? Okay, but I can hear it too, so it's distracting me. Can you understand me, at least? It's very depressing to me to share all these beautiful thoughts and then at the end have you tell me that nobody heard it. That's why I stopped. I already know these things, most of them, or at least. No, that's not actually true, because I'm speaking in the moment with ideas that have just come to me. So I want to hear them too, but anyway, let's go on with this. But nonetheless, I was starting to say, being creative enough to see an alternative. But in this particular temple, because this is a relatively new teaching, we have Paramhansa Yogananda, who, yes, he left this earth in 1952, which as time passes is really now quite a long time ago. But nonetheless, it was recent enough that we have a photograph of him. We have a book that he wrote. We have recordings of his voice. On rare occasions, we actually see movies of him walking around and talking. Many more movies exist, but they're not accessible. They're held privately and they only leak out frame by frame, as it were. But nonetheless, he lived in the time when these recordings, a visual and audio record of his being are right there. So we have a sort of in-between reality. And even though most of the people who knew him have exited from this planet, and only a handful of true disciples, highly trained disciples, are still living, of whom the founder of Ananda is one, Swami Kriyananda. He's one of about five, maybe only four now, of those who really spent their life with Yogananda. Still, we have this paradox between life and death. Of who are we following? What is his power? Where does he come from? How do we feel it? And this is really the essence of the spiritual path, is this balancing point between the seen and the unseen, between that which we can understand with reason and that which we must embrace with intuition, and the necessity to balance our intuition so it's not just imagination, but that it really becomes something that is as real to us as any other thing that we hold. In fact, Patanjali, who was a great sage of yoga, who wrote the Patanjali's aphorisms, that the Yoga Sutras, they're called. One of the things he says is one of the dangers on the spiritual path is the danger is false visions. That it's very easy for us to become overwrought with our imagination and then think that things are happening. And oftentimes we have to work through lifetimes where we discern the difference between what we project from our own subconsciousness and what actually descends to us from superconsciousness. And if we've been karmically through those sort of things, we become extra suspicious and want to keep everything really grounded. But Yogananda, in the excerpt, the voice excerpt we were listening to, was talking about the death of Lahiri Mahashaya, who was a guru who preceded Yogananda in this line. As you look at it, he's on your left. That's a photograph, an actual photograph of Lahiri Mahashaya. So Yogananda tells the story of how Lahiri Mahashaya died in the 1800s. The day after he died, actually three or four different of his disciples saw him. And Yogananda emphasizes in there that it wasn't a vision. It was the flesh and blood body, just as we're looking at. And in the story of the resurrection of Jesus, it's emphasized in there that it was exactly the same, that he was just there walking among them. And even as I was listening to Yogananda speak, a little piece of your mind, as they describe Sri Yukteswar appearing in Swami Pranabananda's room, he'd gotten a letter to come to Varanasi, to come to Benares and see Lahiri. He was delayed in his departure. He was packing his bag to go. And all of a sudden, Lahiri walks in. Lahiri is hundreds of miles away as far as the disciple is concerned. He says, "Oh, Master, I'm on my way to see you." Lahiri says, "Don't bother, I'm not there anymore." And of course, the disciple's first thought is, "No, because you're here." But Lahiri says, "No, I'm not anywhere. I'm standing in front of you, but I've now left this earth." And even as he says that, in my mind, there's a kind of shimmer around Lahiri Mahashaya, and he's semi-transparent. That's the way I picture it. So the disciple himself emphasizes he held the body. It was a flesh and blood body, just like the body he was used to seeing. Yogananda describes when he was in India in 1936, his own guru on your right, as you look at the picture to the right of Jesus there, Sri Yukteswar lived until 1936, and he died when Yogananda had gone back to India. He went back to India because his guru called him, because he knew that his life, the guru's life, was almost over, Sri Yukteswar's. So he dies while Yogananda's in India, and then Yogananda is distraught. He's weeping dark tears, just as he describes in what David read. And then Sri Yukteswar walks in. There he is. And Yogananda emphasizes, he knelt down, he felt his canvas shoes, and Yogananda writes an autobiography, he felt his toes, feet, you know, pressing through those canvas shoes, because many times as a young disciple, he'd knelt and touched those feet. And he embraced his guru, and he said he sensed the same emanation, sweet emanation of the fragrance of his guru's body. He held it in his arms like this, and in fact, jokingly, it says, Sri Yukteswar says, "If I'm going to talk to you, you're going to have to loosen your grip." You know, Yogananda was so pleased to see him because Yogananda himself had buried Sri Yukteswar's body in the ground of the ashram where he had died. Yogananda arrived just after his guru had died. He did all the rituals. They dug a big hole in the sand. They placed his guru's body still in the lotus posture down in the ground. They sealed it up. Yogananda had done all of that. So when Sri Yukteswar walks back in, there's a little bit, of course, Yogananda's playing a little game with us, but this is how he writes it, that there it is, and it's a flesh and blood body. And this completely makes a mockery, just a complete mockery of what almost every human being in this world lives with, which is this belief that when the physical body dies, it's final, and we put consign the body to the ground or put it in the cremation fire, and it's just gone. My own parents died a number of years ago. I had long since left home and, in fact, only saw them infrequently. But even still, the fact of their absolute absence, just that there's nowhere and no power that can bring back that body to walk back into where you're standing, is just one of the absolutely unequivocal facts of life, except it isn't. Because these masters come and they just tell us that this world is simply not what it seems. And they challenge us by the methods they give us, not merely to be highly impressed with their accomplishments, but also to actually walk the very path that they've walked. Now, in Christianity, again, because Jesus has been taken so far away from anything that relates to our life here. And large portions of his life have been taken out of the Bible, and the dogmatism that's built up around it just pushes him farther and farther away from us. This was done out of some intention of devotion to show how fabulous he is, just like a storyteller who gets a good laugh out of a certain line will be inclined to push that line a little farther. You know, being a storyteller, I know, you tell the joke, it works, you embellish it a little, and pretty soon you've moved a little bit away from what the original script was. So with Jesus, you know, he just got bigger and bigger. And then he was born by the Immaculate. He was not conceived in a normal way, and neither was his mother, you know. And then his birth becomes more and more big, and this goes over really well. So it gets bigger and bigger. But what happens to us is we become more and more confused about who that master is. And then it becomes more and more of supplicating. It's almost like a beggar asking someone who's so far above you, literally, have mercy upon me. You know, here I am, a poor sinner, groveling in the earth like a worm, and you, so far above me, you know, drop a little bit of your grace on me. And in fact, that grace will come and it will transform you, but it still doesn't give you like a solid here and now relationship with what's really going on in our lives or in the divine. And I think in this time, what people want is not more and more fairy tales. What they want is something we can really understand. As Yogananda said, the master sent him to America because Americans are a practical people. And we just want to understand and know what we're supposed to do. Now, here is the reality as the scriptures describe it and as yoga's master describes it also, that those who become self-realized masters have actually lived through exactly the same process that we are in the middle of. We were manifested from the infinite. As we say in our Festival of Light, the bird is sent out symbolically. We describe the bird is sent out from the nest with a divine mission to experience the divine and to be an instrument of the divine. But the bird gets a little bit puffed up with its own importance, and it begins to think more and more about what I'm getting out of this. And even though we're like children sent out to play, you know, in the beautiful lawn, we get really interested in the parking lot, and then what's beyond the parking lot, and then the busy street beyond that. And then we get sort of wandering away, and we have to relate to all these unexpected realities, and then it takes us a long time to figure out how to get back here. But the progress of a soul over many, many incarnations is to face, to understand, and to transcend one, well, the word is temptation, after another, one false image of the source of our happiness. The divine bliss that dwells within us, but the light radiating from us appears to have its source in those things that are reflecting our own life back to us. If we walk around with a miner's lamp on top of our head, planted there and we never knew it, and it's shining out on the world and the world is made of reflective stuff, it looks shiny to us, doesn't it? So we grab this and we grab that, and that looks attractive and this looks good, and you get it right up close and all of a sudden it doesn't quite have the life that you thought it had, because we don't understand that we are giving it the light ourselves. And gradually over time, our point of exploration becomes more and more internalized, until from our actual experience we recognize all that I'm ever experiencing is my own inner consciousness. And then we begin to realize that the very source of light that we're chasing in all directions is really inside of me. And the more I become conscious of that, the more I have everything that I'm seeking. All of us can look at the progress of this one incarnation, and we can see how we have lived through certain realities and then understood them on a deeper level. And if we are following our path righteously, that deeper level, as I say, leads us deeper and deeper inside. And the attraction for this, the desire for that, we don't have to fight to push it away. It's just no longer attractive to us because we've found something sweeter and more everlasting. Now, what I want to emphasize here is that every great saint, every master, every avatar, every fully realized being, like Jesus and Buddha and Krishna and Paramhansa Yogananda, Lahiri Mahashaya, Sri Yukteswar, all of them lived through exactly what we are living through. I don't mean even like close. And they weren't pretending. They were manifested as individual souls. It's called the jiva, the individuality, the divine individuality. That's your jiva. And they lived through it. They were tempted by money. They were tempted by power, by intoxicants, by drugs, by sex, by wrong action, by selfishness. And step by step, in exactly the same way that we have learned, they learned. Yes, it's inconceivable. One of the disciples of Yogananda was being urged to do something that he found difficult to do. And he protested to Master and said, Master, of course you can do it, because you're a master. And Yogananda looked at him and said, with great power, and what do you think made me a master? He said, it was by doing, not by affirming weakness. Now, the point of that is very deeply important in this sense. The master understands us. He loves us. He's absolutely patient with us. There is nothing that we are experiencing, no weakness, no failure, no procrastination, no unwillingness to meditate, no meanness of heart, no self-aggrandizement. Not only does he understand it, he lived through it. Right where you're standing, Jesus Christ himself in consciousness once stood. And the sweetness of that realization, the complete relaxation within our hearts of any sense of shame or self-protection, if you can embrace that as completely as it is true, it can be one of the most liberating attitudes that you can find. It's like, okay, Jesus, here I am, totally caught in this power struggle at work with this sadistic boss, and I can't afford to quit the job. What am I going to do? What did you do? You know, people say, ask the question, what would Jesus do? Well, ask what he did. When you were faced with this same human dilemma, how did you solve it? How did you get from where I'm standing to your state of realization? Remarkable to contemplate, isn't it? Now, you see, the reason the masters come back to us is because they want to bring to us, through their realized form, the complete human experience ending in the divine. And in what David read, Master writes, he said, I will take the role that you have given me. I'm no longer compelled by my own misunderstandings, but out of my compassion, greater can no love be than this, from a life of infinite joy and freedom to return to this world of limitation just to help others. And Master says, even I will writhe in anguish with my disappointments. They don't just come and pretend to be here. They really live this life with us, except at every turning, they show us how to turn that experience toward the divine. Master, all his money was taken by treacherous disciples. He was sued in the courts. He was insulted in the newspapers. He was accused of immoral behavior. I mean, all of this, none of this is remembered or publicized. But Master lived in a human body and a human life. But every human experience that came to him, he turned it toward God. You see, it isn't a question, and this is where Jesus' life being so sanitized is really unfortunate. I mean, of course, he was crucified in the end, but we don't ever really see him as a living, breathing man, more so lately. But you understand what I'm saying. We have to realize that the masters lived through it and emulate the vibration of their consciousness. Now, we don't have to know all the details to meet that vibration. And you can hear it in his voice, you can draw it from his words, you can draw it from his music, you can receive it from those who are in tune with him. And what we receive is an inner vibration of alignment. And once we are aligned, then we know what to do. It isn't so much that we need to be told step by step. If you think about it, when we get confused is when we're scattered all over the place. I've been working, helping with the school play, which is going to come be performed in 10 days or so. And I was getting very involved with all of the details of the whole costume and letting myself become a little like that. And I was walking across to Starbucks to get a solid, real caffeinated cup of latte. The founder of Starbucks has a word when his employees show up before their morning cup of coffee. He calls them pre-caffeinated. So I was pre-caffeinated, and I needed to be caffeinated, and I was still like this, and I carry this sort of open bag for a purse. I have no idea how, but right in the middle of the street, I picked up my bag from the bottom instead of the top, and I just turned it over in the middle of the road. Fortunately, I'm not one of these big luggage sort of purse persons, but you know, that was enough that just rolled all around in the middle of the street, and I'm standing there watching myself, having dumped my purse onto the floor, picking up my cell phone and my stuff like this on my hands and knees in the road. And I thought, I think there's something wrong with my consciousness. Like, here's a clue. And it's just like my vibration was off. And all I did at that point was, oh, this is silly. We're supposed to be having fun. Just, you pull it back to center. Nothing had changed, not one whit. Not one piece of fabric had been sewn, not one sequin had been pinned on, not one villain had his black mask, nothing. But the vibration shifted. It shifted back to, oh, we're here for joy. What does it matter? We're here for joy. You see, that's what the masters tell us, and that's why Master says in the words that David's reading, I'm not going to be dragged out of this world kicking and screaming. I'm going to do my job as God gives it to me. And then when he pulls me out of this world, I will go with a joyous heart. You know, we don't have to wait till it's over to go with a joyous heart. This is what the masters emanate to all who received him. Jesus said, to them gave he the power to become the sons of God. Jesus, Master, Buddha, all of these great ones, just keep giving this back, giving it back. Swami Kriyananda was asked in a radio interview a couple of days ago, are you happy? And he sort of paused and couldn't answer that word, because what he describes is a state of bliss so profound he can hardly speak. So he said something like that. But then he gave the most interesting definition of happiness. I loved it. He said, to be truly happy is to desire and to commit yourself and to give your energy to making everyone else in the world as happy as you are. Because it's the nature of happiness to want to share itself. That's the explanation of why God created this whole world. God is bliss. It's the nature of happiness to want to share itself. And this is what you see, what the masters do. Greater can no love be than this. In that state of infinite bliss, as they were reading today from Swami's autobiography, most souls, once they finally get through this, they're never coming back. But some just want to make everyone as happy as they are. And that's all that the masters are doing. They're just vibrating this complete happiness, and they want everyone to be just as happy as they are. Yes, it's a very elaborate and a rather complex process, and I'll give you one last thought. We are working, as I mentioned, on the school play. The school play is a kind of madness that descends on our school once a year, because you think, oh, a children's play. You line up a few kids, they say a few poems, they're dressed like pumpkins, and you send them off the stage, and somebody plays the piano behind them. Not at Living Wisdom School. It's like an hour and a half, 2-hour production, a total seamless theater show. Just start to finish theater magic. There's no place where it's a children's show. It's a really good play. It requires so much from the teachers, so much from the kids, that about this time, which is like 1 week before the performance pretty much everybody involved in it says, why do we do this? You know, why are we doing this? But I was reflecting on, among other things, what it teaches the children, which is the more you give, the more exciting it is. The higher you set your goals, the more dynamic it can be. And really, the reason the faculty continues to do this is we want these children to be as happy as we are. And we know that where true happiness comes from is when you tune in to the infinite possibilities of life. So often in life, people just want to play safe. My own father said to me toward the end of his life, I was urging upon him some dynamic task or another, and he was in his 80s by then, and I said, don't you want to grow? I said to him. He said, no. And I realized, no, he was done. And shortly after that, he let his mind go and spent the last 2 years in a kind of happy la-la land. He just went on vacation. You know, it was perfect. But when he said that to me, I said, oh, that's right, you don't. You know, and I began to work with him entirely differently. But God just waits until we do, because we will never be happy until we have perfect bliss. And to have perfect bliss, what do you think made me a master? It was by meeting the challenge, by expanding the possibilities, by rising to meet them, and finding the bliss of God behind it.